I have a mix of, I'm Polish by origin, and I spent some time in academia in Poland, in Warsaw School of Economics, when I returned now after 20 years of working for the United Nations. And I work mostly in economic sectors of the UN and in some analytical sectors with a strong focus on transition countries. It was a big buzz when I arrived to New York in 1990. So I worked for DESA for Economic and Social Survey, and then I work for Human Development Report Office at the being a senior economist there on poverty reports and globalization, but covering very much the area of transition countries. This was actually a very wide spot on the work of the UN, because mostly the work was done on developing countries, and it was an assumption that Eastern Europe and socialist countries are developed, and they really wanted to be treated like that at the UN. So there was no problem. They were developing, everything was fine, until things collapsed. And I think until there was a very huge costs of the transition, and poverty increased up to almost 68-70% of population in such countries like Tajikistan, and but also others. You know, there were Kyrgyzstan, it's very close to that, Central Asian countries, but also in so-called, okay, but I will talk about this later, in so-called rich countries in Eastern Europe, where Poland, Hungary, they were considered really, you know, middle income, high level, high end of the middle income. But poverty increased there enormously. And some of the estimates from the early 1990s of the World Bank, of Branko Milanovic, just showed that most households, over 50%, are just floating around the poverty line of $2 a day. So, which was different from the $1 a day because of the climate and some of the food requirements to cover. So it was a surprise for everybody how it could collapse. And I actually, what I want to went th go through with you, I wanted to go through a little bit about the concept of transition and the policies. Okay, I put up some summary here. I would like to show, first of all, the diversity within transition countries, then talk about transition policies and gender, and the results of shock therapy, but also a very strong gender bias in sharing the costs and opportunities, and then look at the current situation and the crisis. In fact, what I would try to argue now is that the case of transition countries, Eastern Europe, you know, I cover by this notion quite many countries, and they are, I would say, 27 or 28, even more, because now they are new EU members, eight of new members of the European Union, and they're really growing very fast, based and catching up based on the EU money. They are receiving a lot of structural funds and the assistance, and they are catching up. But you have also a number of countries which were really were established out of the former Soviet Union republics. You have Central Eastern Europe, Central Europe, which is, for example, Ukraine, Moldova. These countries didn't exist. They were republics of Soviet Union, with a lot of consequences for their development. Also, countries in Central Asia were not independent. They were part of the Soviet Union. So they were all republics. They all have their links to Moscow. Everything was going through Moscow, the transportation, education, but also statistical reporting was going to that. These were also countries which had, some of them were not independent national entities for 200, 300 years. So they had to rebuild everything from the scratch. They also had very little of memories of the market, because they were really very, you know, like governing by the Tsar from Russia, from Moscow, and they had some structures, tribal structures, but they didn't have a market like as such. Then you have also a group of Balkan countries, which when after 1989, when socialism collapsed, in fact, Poland was the first country which opened the way, and then the Berlin Wall fell down. The whole Yugoslavia, which was also a federation of small countries, collapsed, and they had the same situation. They have a very strong conflict, which nobody thought could happen in Europe. Everybody thought conflicts are in Africa. But this was really a very heavy military conflict with lots of victims. Women were very much victims of this process. But they had to rebuild the post-conflict economies. And also you have very poor countries. I mentioned already those countries, but I could say that, for example, the poorest are similar in their development indicators to very poor countries in Africa. So we have to see the diversity and some challenges, which are, of course, not the same. But there are some common threats of these policies. First of all, transition policies were very much defined by neoliberal policy with this so-called Washington consensus. And this was still when everybody believed, at least those who were advising Poland and these countries, that this is going to work. Now, you can think and ask a question. Why people in these countries believed in that? Why policymakers believed that market, invisible hand of the market, were, you know, solve all the problems, stimulate growth, and first of all, do something which everybody expected from abolishing socialism, which means prosperity and well-being, very much like American dream. They were thinking they will all have cars and houses, and they will have abundant goods in shops. So when it all started, they were a very receptive recipients of this kind of an advice, because it would have been very nice. So you just establish the market, and then it will go just by itself. You need just to cut the state, you need just to cut kindergartens, all the state benefits provided through, not only through the central government, but also through enterprises. Because now if you remember, but I would just go very shortly and link it with the previous session. In fact, the failure of socialism was a failure to create a social man, a man which will be the opposite of this homo economicus, who thinks about himself. And this will be a new man. They use the terminology, this utopian socialist from Britain, Great Britain, and the other. They used new men. And this new men were supposed to care about the others. And their motivation to do good work, to be a good doctor, a good teacher, but also work in a factory, will be less driven by self-interest and money, and this will be more driven by contributing to the social well-being. Okay, it didn't work. And I must say it was a failure, because men proved to be selfish, and they wanted for themselves. They wanted better living, houses, cars, and they didn't want to give it to others too much. And the system of incentive didn't work, so the production system could not work effectively. So the production was going down and down, and there were different reforms, trying to reform plant economy and make it a bit more market economy, but within the system of plant economy. Okay, the things which China didn't work that much with Eastern Europe. There were different conditions. And also, there was a very strong pressure for human rights and democracy movements, which was solidarity in Poland, but also other countries had similar movements. So there was a movement towards the change. Now, when this advice came from Washington, from different advisors from Europe, Western Europe, they were very numerous advising Polish government, Czech government, but also Russian government and the others, what they should do to make market democracy happening in their countries. And people really were very idealistic, thinking that this was Kornai was maybe some of you are familiar with him, his work. He had a very good analysis why it didn't work. And finally, all this lack of good incentives produced shortage economy. When by the end of 1980s, when I remember very well, and some of them, maybe my younger colleague does not remember that, but in the shops, there was just practically nothing. You couldn't buy meat, you couldn't buy bread, you couldn't buy milk, just nothing. It was empty shelves, and there were long, long lines because this was a shortage of supply. And people, of course, had money to buy because all the goods were priced very low, but they couldn't buy it. So they couldn't get it. Okay, there was a free healthcare, free education, and so on. But for example, you couldn't get the free healthcare because the hospitals were packed. So you couldn't get in. You had to bribe the doctor. So you needed some money. So the stabilization, so the recipe was basically stabilize the economy, then privatize and open, liberalize. And this will work. And it was a package which was modeled very much by understanding of market economy as it worked in developed market economies in Western Europe. And also some programs for Latin America were also taken as example. They said, oh, it worked there well, so then let's go for that. I was talking already for high expectations. Now, gender was a non-issue in this whole policy. And there were a number of reasons for that. First of all, as Nilüfer was telling us last session, neoliberal concept does not really have a space for this gender inclusion of perspective. But secondly, also, it was a very strong perception that gender is social. And the main task of these countries will to do economics and to do market, economics, price, liberalize everything. This has nothing to do with this process, right? Democratization was a little bit more difficult maybe to argue because women should be included, but still the main groups which were promoting this democratization process, there were very few women. And if you see, well, power play, I will come to that, but there was, when transition started, there was in fact a very specific power play when the lobbies of old strong groups under socialism were getting strong position because these were workers in heavy industry, steel industry, coal mines, etc. Women were completely outside this process. They had no power at all. And you can see that the round table, famous round table, which discussed in June 1989 the new system, when it was a little bit like half and half, there was still, the president was still a socialist, a communist, and the party still remained, but they divided mandates in the parliament. There were the first free elections. So the round table discussed that. There was only one woman, and I think around 80 men, and this picture was shown now, and it was amazing. It was completely amazing. I didn't know myself. And I met this woman. She's an unbelievable woman, but she was the one. Sorry, yeah. She got a prize at this Congress of Women, which I was talking about at the beginning, when I presented myself just now, 26th, 27th of June in Warsaw. She was very close to Lech Walesa, Solidarity, and she was the one who actually organized the strike of tram workers in one of the cities. She herself was a driver of trams. And when the main Solidarity wanted to finish the strike, she said, no, we have to continue. And she make a plea to Walesa to please continue, we will support you. And this is, there's a claim that it started the whole, you know, wave of strikes throughout the Poland. So she's a very strong, very concrete, and very action-oriented woman who married late. She adopted 12 children and created a home for them. She's full of energy. She's grandmother now. And she was the one sitting at the table. There were many women sitting in the second rows as advisors, as experts, as, secretaries and, logistic people. But also what we observed, and I skip a bit, is that, you know, in the socialism system, there were quotas for women in the parliament. And of course, as part of the democracy, these quotas were removed. So the share of women in the parliament dropped immediately to few percent. And they were in some countries 3 to 4% from 30, 25. So they had no power to do anything. They were just, very passive observers what's going on. This was combined also with a very substantive rise of traditional attitudes in most of these countries, at least in Poland, but in others as well. The church played a very important role in driving the movements towards democracy. They're all of the Polish Pope and the others. So there was a very big push from these groups. Okay. Women have their role, and this is a specific role within a household. And, of course, as a result, Poland has the most restrictive abortion law, which you cannot really do an abortion, even if a girl is raped. She's 14, and that was the case recently. And the director of the hospital refused to give her an abortion, though she, by constitution, she had the right. But there were groups from the church saying that, look, this is not correct because this is an ethical value, a moral value. She cannot do it. And she tried to brainwash her. And, 14-year-old girl, raped. That's a very extreme case. But this is what is the result. So the power play, so this was a neoliberal concept, the power play, which was completely leaving women out. Then you had also, I was talking about that a bit, the sense of history happening. So you were feeling that this is such a big moment, and talking about gender is like talking about some small flower when you have, a big, fire of the wood or something. And then, of course, there was a perception that women were very well covered in these countries. And indeed, they were represented in the parliament. I was talking about that. There was high share in employment, the highest in European countries, very high, much higher than in the US and in Western Europe. And of course, they were very generous benefits. You have creches and kindergartens, etc., etc. Okay, the quality was not great, as I was saying, the shortage economy played a role, but still, it was still, people were thinking that way. So women are not really the priority. Now, okay, what were the macro result of the shock therapy? This is called shock therapy, but not everybody took the same approach. Some countries took a bit different approach. They tried to protect, and they were not going that fast with liberalization. For example, Poland was trying to get a partnership of trade unions, and there were very heavy lobbies not to allow the process going so fast. But some countries opened unconditionally, and they had a very negative effect. And these effects were basically the GDP collapse, but all these countries went through it. But, I gave just one figure here. In 2000, only 4 out of 27 countries reached pre-transition level. 2000, it's not so far away. Of course, then the economic growth pick up, and most of these countries developed at, 6, 8, up to 10%, Central Asian countries and others, very fast. But it tells that the whole decade was of a slump. Then you have, and this is really the most important, because you had actually the massive redistribution of assets and entitlements. This was privatization, and these were really entitlements of benefits through the system of healthcare and education, which I believe determined very much who got opportunities. It was like cost and opportunities. So who benefited and who could start a new life under this wonderful market economy, market democracy? And I would show you a few figures saying that gender was a major dimension, and that's why I believe that it's just a showcase maybe how the crisis can affect even in countries which were relatively, rich, middle income. They were not poor countries. First of all, loss of job security, increase of competition on the labor market produce very sharp increase in unemployment, and also GDP decline, of course, people will shed off. And there was a huge increase of poverty inequalities. I was telling about poverty, but what is very telling is that inequality as measured by Gini coefficients, you know, it skyrocketed. And this was from the lowest in the world to one of the highest in the world. And this was from 0.22, even a 0.18, like in Czech Republic, there was the very low, the, you know, people were equal. The level, the disparities in wages were very flat. The wages were very flat in socialism. Everybody was getting, you know, the cleaning lady was getting the same as the professor. But everybody had job security. So that's why, in fact, what Nilüfer was saying about poverty, poverty was looked at something as people being lazy and not wanting to work or having some mental problems because, you know, they could get everything. So officially, there was no poverty figures for socialism. And officially, there was no poverty assistance. And all social assistance was completely undeveloped. The state was caught being completely unprepared. There was no unemployment, so there was no system of unemployment benefits. There was no social support system for poor, but yes, there was no poor. So it was really happening very fast, and many people paid a price, and I think many of these people women. You see, I will give you more figures on that. You have to see that the move towards privatization was very, very fast. Most enterprises, state enterprises, which were privatized, they cut immediately all the benefits. And everything which was on public services, there was some tendency to privatize everything. So you had income-based access. You know, there were, of course, private doctors and private schools in education started to grow. Okay, now just give you a few figures, but that's between 1985, this is the data which I had a larger paper which I will also give you, it's part of the publication Gender Gap and Economic Policies, which I edited and I contributed parts of it. Between this 85-97, actually female labor force fell by one-third in some countries, and like Hungary, Latvia, and it declined even in countries where male labor force remained the same or even increased. So, because before you could argue that, of course, because everything went down and male unemployment also were cut, then women and men were affected. But I compared it, and this didn't look like this. And this affected, of course, cuts in employment, which were up to 40%, which is quite telling that even the smallest cut in female employment in Czech Republic was 10 times more, yeah. Oh, this I don't remember now because I have to look at the data which are there. I don't have the tables. That's why I wanted to make the paper. But this was from very high levels. This was 60, 65, 70%. And they went down. So it was for a rapid changes within a few years. This was a very, very sharp decline. Sorry? That's exact. The highest level of the working, but that was this perception that women are very well placed. They are 30% of parliaments, they are, because in some countries even more. In labor market, they were up to 70% participation rates, so they were very active. They have support. In fact, when you look at that, you can say that this socialist system is what now some of the, you know, when I attend different conferences, this is what you ask for. You know, you ask for childcare, kindergarten, state provision, free healthcare, etc., which enables women to work. And they are officially very well represented in parliaments. And it was like a joke because it was really a very difficult struggle to meet ends, especially under conditions where women still were responsible for children and family and doing all the cooking and all the other things under shortage. I remember my grandmother was so happy if she could get once a week some meat. And she was so happy. She said, oh, today we will eat for dinner meat. And meat, by the end of socialist time, communist socialist time, we had ratios for meat and sugar. and all the other things. So, you know, some people don't remember, forgot that very quickly, but it was quite unbelievable, let's say. And I think it also tells you how difficult it is to create this social man and new man, because, you know, you just have to have some other interest, because even under socialism, people will work superbly well if this was some small private shop, which were allowed in Poland. But they would not work on the so-called state job, because they would try to combine. They were getting very little money for that, so they were just coming to work but not really doing the job. So it was really unemployment on the job. This is what you had in Russia when unemployment rates for female unemployment, it had a very mixed pattern, because it was not like they showed a very high unemployment rate. In some countries, yes, but not in others, in the Balkans in particular. In Georgia, I think, in the Caucasus. But in others, not. But this was this reflected this withdrawal of women from the labor market, which some of them were lured by promises of very generous benefits, like for children, family policies. And one of the results which was very telling is the very fast-growing wage gap, which is now between 40% and 60% in Caucasus and Central Asia. In other countries in Eastern Europe and Central Europe is about 15%, 18%, 20%, depending on the profession, depending on the part. But this will the consequences. Okay, now opportunities. They took the costs. And I really look at this, and I believe that women took most of the costs of the transition. And they were not given opportunities, because where were opportunities? In the private sector. And this is, you know, the state sector was shutting down and the private sector was booming. So, private sector opportunities were limited very much for women by discrimination in hiring. And this is because of women still kept, women still were expensive workers in terms of social costs, because maternity benefits, pregnancy, all these things remained on paper mostly, but they remained. So if enterprises were hiring in the private sector, they had to obey. So they preferred to hire men. And there were many, many documented papers looking into that. But also, which was quite interesting, is that, you know, how you get into the private activity, private sector, when you didn't get any assets. So how you get credit, how you get, possibilities to move on. And what this woman did in transition countries were just miracles. You know, this SME sector was driven by women in Georgia, in Kazakhstan, in Poland. This is one of the highest in Europe. And they did it out of scratches, out of nothing, out of small money borrowed from the neighbor, from the family, very much like in African countries. And they really made it very well. Okay, I have to speed up a little bit, but I wanted to make sure that we can observe this very smart, I would say, and in a special way smart policy of most government. The government say, "Oh, yeah, care provisions declined in the public sector, but women will be willing to do this loving work of caring with at home. So we will just encourage them, giving them a little bit of carrots in terms of early retirement, of maybe some additional money for the next child, and then that's it." And this is really amazing how it worked. In most policies, if you look at policies of the Polish government, this is how it was throughout, very, very much like in other countries as well. And, now the current crisis, risks and opportunities. Because what I think is interesting is to look at this case of transition countries as showing the arguments that, okay, this is how it was very, risk and opportunities did not weigh each other. Now, we can say for risk, like déjà vu, this is what we've seen already. So you risk, of course, job loss, less access to resources and credit, because now, banks are really constraining credits. Most of the Polish and other Eastern European banks are foreign banks, and they have troubles at home. Austrian banks, Italian banks, and others, they just take money out of this daughter or subsidiary banks because they don't want to lose on the domestic ground. So this is really a very much like forbidden practice by Basel Convention, but they still do it. So the credit is getting very, very scarce. Now, opportunities, what I see, and I refer very much what Nielifor said, building the challenging this mainstream economic paradigm and looking to the options for heterodox paradigm in times when most economies are, well, convinced a bit for the crisis and they want to regain face and tell something how the new macroeconomic policies should look like. Because it's obvious that it failed. So very few economies now dare to say it's perfect, it was very well. And at least in these countries, not so much. So I think at the level of the stimulus package, I think I don't have much of the data here. And it's quite a lot of possibilities. I see one example I just took, that most countries, when I look at their programs, they want to stimulate demand through SME and the job creation through SME. So this should be a very loud proposal saying, give it to women, or at least look to what extent the part of the stimulus package is going to men and women. But what is more important is to rethink growth strategy and the role of the state and public finance. This is a very good time to do it, and I think now these transition countries are ready, more ready, because they already forgot a bit this hangover from socialist times, shortage economy. They're not so enthusiastic about the market. They are a little bit more open to the new thinking. And I think it's a very good time to do it. But also, I would like to say, redesigning global architecture. You cannot work alone only at country level. You need to work also at international level. Why? And I want to go through this, what arguments you can use in this moving. Okay, in Europe, they are the main source of new labor, but they are also they bring quality aspects of growth. They bring also skills and management styles, which I think it's important because if you look, I will go maybe on the next slide. This potential is important in the time of the crisis. I wanted to show this slide because I think it's quite telling. Unfortunately, I had data only for EU 27. If we are today here, this is the 2040, and if the participation rate of women remain at the same level as today, the Europe will EU 27 will have a deficit on the labor market of 24 million people. If the participation rates of women will equal to that of men, this will be only 3 million. It has a very heavy implications for the state budget, for the pension system, sustainability, and so on. And I believe that it would be quite important to use this argument. They are very well educated. I will go one slide there. But I want to draw the attention here to the study, which I'm sure that you know, and maybe not so, because it was done in Europe, in France. There was a study trying to correlate the number of women in the boards of banks and different other enterprises on the stock exchange, French stock exchange, and the results. And I took just one, but they did the result for a number of companies, all of them listed, for which there were data. And it's a very strong correlation between the share of women in management and the drop in shares. Okay, the more women, the less drop in shares. Why? I think there are different explanations, but one of the issue is that, in fact, it's not either women or men should run it. But if you took it together, women have different propensity to risk, and they have a different priorities, different attitudes towards investing money. And if they participate at the company boards, they can actually make some difference. And it's quite interesting that many of the banks are now interested in starting gender programs. And in Poland, I know of some, and they said, oh, this will be a, you know, face-saving operation for us to put some gender on the table. So the issue is it not good enough for feminist economies to accept it? Or maybe just go there, talk to them, and, you know, present some of the values. Now, this is the potential research potential of Eastern Europe and CIS countries. If you look at the average of EU 25, you can see that even very poor countries like Kyrgyzstan has higher potential in the as calculated by the share of women researchers. So this is another argument which in building knowledge-based economy, in building, you know, new economy as a way out of the crisis, you should consider that argument perhaps on a policy level. Okay, this is entrepreneurship. I'm not going to stop there, but everywhere throughout the region, the female entrepreneurship boomed, even in a very, these are the some of the barriers. Okay, I stop just to a minute on gender budgets, and I will go to two last slides. I think this whole topic of gender budgets, which you will discuss later on Friday, I think it's a very important part of the discussion at the time of the crisis. First of all, it really upgrades gender to economic status in mainstream economics. If they talk budget, this is what they understand. They said, oh yeah, indeed, this is how we can relate. This could be also the tool to do these resources and look at the implication of the measures which are taken by countries. But also it could be a pressure to develop more gender disaggregated data, which we can actually monitor the progress and the gaps and the delays in doing things. Now, just the last thing. Who could lead the change for the new heterodox economics? Okay, I don't know. I just put up some very general observations. Governments and public institutions. Okay, yes, there are few governments in Europe, especially Norway and Scandinavian countries, which put up as their priority of foreign policy and economic policy to include gender into economic policies. But they are very few. And other countries do not look at that way. They really look at this through the social policies or through the welfare policies or through the poverty policies. Gender equality machinery, so-called. In these countries, don't know much about economics, most of them. I mean, they are willing, they understand the weight, but if they are invited to be partners, I mean, it's done pro forma. They are invited sometimes to the discussions with governments about the new strategy, response to the crisis, and so on. They cannot really be too much as an equal partner to this discussion. Feminist economists in academia, yes, I believe that this is really one of the forces which could actually advance things. But putting much more clearer concept, which would be easy to use, and a little bit more arguments. I would say also women business associations are really organizing themselves very well and are trying to do the same because this is a matter of survival for them. They cannot really have their voice not heard in the SME policies. And private sector, again, it's a matter of, you know, some moral, you know, is it an enemy or should feminist economies, I just stop and, is it the feminist economies say, oh, these are the bad guys. I mean, everything. We should not talk to them or we should use it. It's a question. I don't have any, you know, thorough answer to that. But I observe it as a trend. Civil society, yeah, I should have put them under a gender machinery / this because they work very closely. They do, but they have the same problem that the knowledge of economics, you know, they do many workshops on economics, many this, but you cannot train in a week time somebody who's a political science in economy to talk to people who prepare a macroeconomic strategy for a country. It's just not possible. They can bring, yes, and they should bring, but they should have... I'm almost finishing. Okay, international level. I think there's a huge role for the international level and it should interact with the feminist economies. You know, setting norms, standards, a commitment, of course, Beijing, MDG, financing for development. But But I think what we neglect a little bit is this regional dimension, you know, regional banks in Latin America, in Africa, in this. Why not to push through that? Because I think it's a good channel to be heard. The lessons are, I think it's a showcase, both to say, watch out, don't repeat the same things because it's very dangerous, but also be a bit more positive and say these are the opportunities and this is this possibility to have it as a factor of growth, because we know that women are well educated, they have this, it's just giving them a lift. So that's a key factor of economic growth and allocation of resources. So I thank you for that, for your attention. I was a bit too fast, and I would like very much to open the discussion, because not everything what I said is, it's could be a bit accepted. This is what I observed from the case of these countries. But I think there are a few issues, what and how neoliberal group doing economic policy should link with heterodox group, feminist economists included, to discuss the new macro policy and in the context of the crisis. How could it be done? Is it useful? Is it not useful? Should it be keeping your own identity and keeping just, you know, we are not mixing with them? We observe this, by the way, a lot with some of these groups which really want to make, for example, women businesses better. Feminist groups despise them, in fact, because the other groups do not like to be called feminist. So I believe it's a question, because if it women's movement will be very compartmented, it's extremely difficult to get a leverage power. And you see very quickly this other side of arguments, which are, let's say, efficiency arguments picking up, and groups which support it. Okay, so that's it. So I wanted to maybe now open the floor for the discussion.
I have one question, that in spite of high level of education, high economic participation, high political participation, women were so strong, and when the transition economies turned to market economy, everything fell down like that. Can you explain how it happened? Because couldn't they fight at all? Because other countries, like country like India, I can understand. But how did it happen in this way? Can you explain the dynamics behind that?
Famous, some of fellows here from Russian-speaking countries will know, there were the famous so-called Potemkin villages, which were created by one of the Tsar minister. And whenever the Tsar was going, he was going ahead and he was making everything very nice, but only on the front. So the houses was in fact empty on the back. And I think this is really what it happened, that the strength of women's movements was very illusory, because this was all run by the Communist Party. And they were like puppets. Yes, in the main decision-making body of the political bureau, they were always two, three, four women out of the maybe 10. But they had nothing to say. There were others. So they were like a front facing. The same for the parliament. The decision-making channels were different. It was a very autocratic system. So that's what it happened. On the side of losing on the labor market, well, they lost because, you know, it's not possible, you know it all well from other regions, compete with men with a very aggressive competition for jobs. When you have a family, or if you have to do both, when you have the cuts of almost all the provision. Now it's quite interesting. Most of the countries return to the idea of restoring kindergartens. But the whole set of kindergartens was completely abolished. And also social functions of the schools, public schools. Women can leave children after school hours. And there were different, you know, teaching languages, going to sports, doing that. Schools cut everything. So how could you deal with that? hospitals were not keeping the patients for 3 weeks, but they were keeping them for 1 week. So they were going home, and yeah. So women felt overburdened, and that was the reason for being less competitive. And this had a very important implication for young generation of women. They didn't want to have children, and the drop of fertility is this country is now, which has one of the highest fertility rates, now to have the lowest in the world, below replacement rate. It's one less than one child per couple. So, you know, I believe it's an argument also to policymakers, because they have to worry about who's going to work and who's going to pay for pensions in the future. And this is I participated once in a very serious discussion, very important people in Poland on the audience side at the Davos Forum, which was organized, and the title was How to Restore Fertility, How to Make Higher Fertility. There were all six men sitting there. And they were all ministers for different, you know, yeah. And they were saying, yes, this is an important issue because of this, because of that. And then I ask a question, then what you propose to do? And you would not believe it. But the answer of one of the very prominent Polish minister, who is now will be maybe the commissioner in Brussels, he said, oh, very simple. Now I go home and I will try to make babies. You see, the mentality is unbelievable. But this is how young.
It has an implication that high level of education or high economic participation, what appears in terms of WPR, workforce participation, or high membership in parliament, what appears on data, are not really adequate indicators of empowerment of women. You have to go in depth to see what exactly how much power women are really holding.
That's very true. You need to really look at the indicators with care. And tomorrow, because we work a lot on indicators, our statistical division had a very strong gender statistics team. And we identified in one of the projects which I coordinated the list of indicators in economics. And this was like filtered through the statisticians, you know, concerns. So I can show it tomorrow when we will be talking. Of course, it doesn't really solve the, you know, you have to scratch. You have to say what it means. But the basic thing, what is really missing, is that women do not have power, and they cannot affect decisions taken on the economic ground as well. And one of the recommendations of this Women's Congress in Poland was quotas for political parties, 50-50, and the second was 100% of male wage. And there were two really concrete pieces which came out of country which is doing very well in the crisis. And country, Poland, is doing one of the best out of Eastern Europe, have, you know, very comfortable EU membership, etc. But what happened in other countries, you see? So then when I look at that, and I said you need a concept, what to put up to economic policymakers, which is well designed with arguments, with data, with everything, but you need political power combined with that. If you don't have it, then you are not heard. And then it looks like these Potemkin villages. You just see the face and, oh, it's perfect. But behind it, not much. It's a really a problem in this part of the world. And sometimes I feel, when I attend different conferences, that women in Africa are much better organized and have much better stand. You know, if I look at South Africa gender budgets, if I look at India, if I look at other, believe me, I feel that these are the cases which should be shown in my country to say, look, this is done. Gender budgets was designed as developing countries, tool for development in developing countries. But it's very much needed in these countries, which are called developed. And this is just starting. They don't have many initiatives. So sometimes really it's a bit upside down. I feel Indian women, African women, when I observe them, I mean, I'm amazed how well they are organized, how strong they voice, and how much they get in return, which is not the case in this part of the world.
I'm just curious how receptive people are in your travels and conversations to what clearly are the failures of shock therapy. And when you have people like Jeffrey Sachs who praise, you know, many people would look at 4 out of 27 and preach the success of that, where, you know, instead of looking at the labor participation of women, they become infatuated with the price of eggs and how that played through. So I was just curious how receptive people like that are to this process, given where they are now in Millennium Development Goals and other international organizations.
Well, I think I just mentioned this very briefly because I think it's a little bit simplification to say that shock therapy was, accepted across the board. And even recently, like last month, I read an interview with Jeffrey Sachs, because after so many years, you know, this is a 20 years anniversary of transition, so they were all this occasional, you know, looking back, lessons. He said, oh, no, this is not what I advised. I come from a, no, that's what, I have this this article. He was saying, I advise to be cautious. I came from a different background. This was not what I was meaning. This was not, you know, it was a little bit, so that's one thing. Second, I can tell you that, so even Jeffrey Sachs is now very much on the other side, but on the really heterodox side, because he was thinking we need to create a new macro policy. But most, many economists, let's say, maybe not most, acknowledge that one of the success of most successful countries was because they did not adopt the shock therapy in full. Well, this would have been a complete disaster, for Poland went really quite slowly with the diversification of wages. They put some caps on wage increases and inequalities, Poland. So they were not so, immediately listening. In the beginning, yes. But then, so the sentiment is that politically, governments could not allow themselves to really adopt that situation. This was less in Russia and Russian-speaking countries and Central Asia, because these countries are still run by a very autocratic system. They are really built basically on tribal system, and they are built on the keeping in balance the different ethnic groups, and the president is taking the power, and then it's run the way. But even in countries, especially in oil countries like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, the governments feel and the presidents feel that they cannot continue like this, that they have to give something to the population. So they have a very extensive social program now in Kazakhstan, welfare program, poverty reduction program, the same Azerbaijan. They want to make people sharing the benefits more than before. The redistribution was done very quickly, but now they want to share because they have a surplus. Out of the energy prices, out of the some of the commodity prices, they have quite a lot of funds. So now, politically, they don't want to have discontent, and they want to give back. But also Uzbekistan, Rashid Khurshid, can tell us about the program of Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan also have a plan for welfare. Plan. It's a, by the way, very well designed plan, and you know, if it's implemented, it will give also benefit women. So it's, you know, the pressure of the population still is there. It's not like you can do whatever advisors are telling, and advisors are backing up as well. They are not so.
Unlike Eastern Europe countries, Uzbekistan did not take at all this shock therapy. President Karimov, he is still since the independence. He chose to take this gradualism approach. Like, he was proposing that this switch to market economy should be followed by a strong social policy. So, Uzbekistan still has not seen any signs of shock therapy, like in its reforms. Only this gradual. But on the other hand, most economists admit that. Shocked, this gradualism is still moving forward the this recession, which is inevitable, which the Eastern European countries faced like in the beginning of the reforms, but most people believe that Uzbekistan is still moving forward and someday it will come, it should come. So it is very controversial, like which policy worked right for these transition economies. And Uzbekistan has really, as you mentioned, that really strong this welfare system. It provides additional transfers to mothers with many children, and very strong transfer system. But this system is being not, the results of this system are being like not so much desired lately, since this inflationary pressure, structural adjustment requirements, therefore I wouldn't say this some of the welfare improvement welfare strategies are really successful. Yeah, and the other as to the women's participation, we still have this quota in the parliament. Women's participation should not be less than 30%, so it's like imposed quota. It's still remainings of the social system, Soviet system. So that's basically.
Yeah, thank you, Rashid. It really, I think there was one, right? Just you want to one. I think it was the system of, as I said, not everybody's shock therapy was not really. In fact, I could not find an example. Maybe Hungary, maybe of a pure shock therapy adopted. Maybe Poland in the very beginning. But other countries were very cautious. And the same for Russia, for example. You know, in Russia what happened, it was a very fast redistribution of assets. In a very special way, I was looking at once at that, this, how it happened. It was very fast, but also in practically men were running big conglomerates, which were equivalent to big corporations in energy sector, heavy industry sector, under socialist times. And they were run like, not private enterprises, but they were very much corporate way of running. So the only change was that they were privatized, and very often managers became owners of this conglomerate. So it didn't change much. It was still a very much big complexes, like 10,000 people, 20,000 people being employed. They split a bit and make some privatization deal to get money. But it was like this. So small sector was not really a priority for Russia, for example. So there were very different phases of this moving. And okay.
I think IMF conditionality is maybe another obstacle for the some of the countries. As far as I know, CE has been hit the worst compared to, for example, the Latin American region. But among the CE, Ukraine and Baltics are being affected the worst. And I know that the Latvia, for example, had to promise budget cuts to secure the IMF loans, because IMF loans became the buffer for the region now. And I want to ask, do you know more about how the crisis is affecting and progressing in those worst affected countries in the CE region, and compared to the transition period, how women are affected in that respect?
Question, but that's really not enough data. In fact, yes, Baltic countries and Latvia are the most affected, and they receive the largest loans and the strongest conditionality from IMF. But I think that they are still looked at as not, well, my interpretation is like this, they are still not that harsh as for some developing countries, and they are not so much, fear that these countries will not pay, because they are practically part of the Scandinavian rich region, and the Swedish banks and Norwegian banks and others. This was part of the problem with the crisis, because they were very much present in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. So they are linked together to a very strong economically countries. So these countries are not so much pushed for making very harsh steps. But I'm going to look into that because I saw some of the initial estimates of the unemployment rate for women, and they increase a lot in Latvia. And they really, the level of unemployment is above 20%. And women in that have, they have lost quite a lot in the labor market. So they will be obviously much more vulnerable. But the data are still not coming enough. But I think this should be looked at very much so. But for example, Poland received an IMF loan, support loan, but without any conditionality, because it is really not to be you. I mean, we don't use it at the moment, and it's more psychological that, you know, if we announce that we receive it, this is more like calming down the market and making sure, okay, everything's fine, and if needed, we will draw on that. So we didn't receive any conditionality. And I know there were some talks, even in Hungary and this, that this conditionality were not so difficult to meet. Of course they were, the deficit and this, they have to constrain a bit. But I would say it would be interesting to compare, you know, the conditions. My intuitive thinking is that they were much less harsh than if any of the African countries applies for such loans, because they would be very much scared if they are able to repay.
Just wanted to add some comments regarding these transitional countries and the characterizing features that is common for these every transitional countries. I mean, education of women and correlation of the use of their education. Because of this hard economic crisis, the education of women at the very beginning appear useless, because almost every industry was falling down, and women were obliged to throw away their diplomas of higher education and do jobs and works that needs no qualification. After the economy has begun to recover, women appear out of the labor force, because now the industries that we are growing up and quite rapidly prefer men to employees, Eva already mentioned, because of law for mortality, for baby care, and so on, so what really exists, and it was maintained through. You see, even in the private sector, it was not very common to pursue this law. Even they were obliged to give women some advantages in this regard. So they prefer not to hire women on this industry. For instance, during Soviet Union, in banks, majority of women were working in the banks. But after Soviet Union has collapsed and Soviet system has collapsed, banks begin recovering, and banks begin gaining big economic profits, and now men prevail in this sector. And on the other hand, women lack economic power to participate in decision making, to be elected during the parliamentary elections. And quotas, it's brave for Poland that you can argue about these quotas, but in our country, in my country, for instance, in Georgia, it is very, very sensitive issue. People, even women, don't want this quota. They regard that it is discrimination. But on the other hand, without this discrimination, without these quotas, we cannot gain any places in parliament, because to be elected and to take part into this process of election, you need some economic power. And women lack this power. On the other hand, all these countries lack democracy, you see. When there is no democracy and transparency, it's very easy to maintain this privilege of men. Because whenever you ensure equal opportunity for all of them, women, I mean educated women, they have this power, they have these resources, they have this potential, can gain the same results as men. For instance, I can provide you a very interesting example from my country. It was examination for courts. And it was really a democratic way to examine men equally to women. It was absolutely without discrimination. And in rural areas, 55% of men and 45% of women managed to pass through this exam. And in urban areas, 55% of women and 45% of men managed to pass through this exam. It's also a real picture of our society because women are more active in urban areas than in rural. But even in rural areas, they have good qualification and good education. So whenever you provide democracy, transparency, and equal participation, these things are working and you can gain some results. So another issue with our country, I can say that it would be more democracy and more transparency. And what's about knowledge-based economy? We are gender blind because resources and qualification in this regard, when you're speaking about knowledge-based economy, it does not matter men or women. It needs just qualification, just knowledge, just innovation, and so on, so on. We are not yet participants of this process. We are just growing up. We are going to this, but nobody knows how we manage because it's long way and we are wasting our potential and we are wasting our qualification in this way. You see? Thank you.
I like very much this point because I want to make just two short points. One slide I didn't show on this. Women should be, as Lilifor also said this, women should actually generate knowledge, be part of the process of generating knowledge, but also being users of knowledge and decision making of what actually knowledge and how you do it. I give you one example. The new strategy of Poland, how to become a knowledge-based economy, because this is now everybody creates some sort of strategies. And when I read it, I just couldn't believe it. There's not a single word about gender. There's an implication of aging. There's a different slice of population by age, by urban, rural, by others, how to mobilize them for the process. But it's nothing about women. And this is what was discussed recently, and we plan to do more work on that because I believe this has to do with the changes in the research system and in the system of support, for example, of young mother researchers who cannot really afford both and they should have some sort of a facility. And this is one of the projects of a Ministry of Education, a woman, she wants to put it into the parliament. But second point is about this financial sector. And this is what happened. In my slides, you will receive all the slides, so you will see it. It was a very interesting shift of the share of women from sectors where average wage increase about the wage in the sector increase as compared to average wage, as compared to others. And the wages increase in financial sector, it was, I don't remember now in all countries, but it was between 1.5 up to twice in a short period, wages increase in terms of average wage. And women moved away out of this. And 20-30%, it's not, they're still there, women, but they are not in the positions, but they really moved away. And when they went to health and education, public sector, which is 80-70% of average wage. And this is what it was, a change in wage system with a transition because there was just a different mechanism. So I think it tells very well the dangers. Women actually recovered, and most of the labor market their position on the labor market in a number of countries because they accepted lower paid jobs. And they accepted jobs which were not equal matching. I think I skipped this slide, but you will see it. I matched the level of the position women take with their education level. And it's unbelievable. You know, they really are not used and they are not fully doing what they could do. And just one case, I mean, many of the doctors, many of the high, professors of physics and others from Ukraine were working in Poland as babysitters. I mean, unbelievable. And in US, but I mean, here it's easier. I was amazed. What a waste. You know, so, and women were in a very good position for education profile because when the transition started, most men had vocational training for the heavy industry, which was very well paid. And women had a general education and they work in services as, you know, administrative and things like this. So they had a broader horizon and it was easier for them to adapt. So they had a head start, but it didn't happen. They still lost on the labor market. So it's really very interesting to look at the data. It differs by country, yes, it differs by the policy, but this is something which could happen, for example, now with a crisis. You know, you can replicate some of the things, and then I was thinking that if you think about proposing to government some of the, you know, what they should do, they all sit there and want to look good. And they all, you know, the discussions about financial crisis in the Polish television, these are mostly women discussing. Deputy ministers of finance, deputy governors of banks, or some of the directors, because men do not want to be associated with this bad topic. They don't want to see, okay, crisis, I am. Our minister of finance, he's very far away. He speaks very rarely. But deputy minister woman, yes, she's very often. Also, in the party, at the party levels, the different people from the party, they're all women. And at once I noticed, very strange, you know, three women were discussing economic crisis. All very senior, relatively senior positions, advisor positions in different political parties. None men. Because they don't want to be associated with the crisis. When the crisis will be away, they want to come back as a nice guys without the tainted picture of the... And besides, I believe they are not really clear on what to do. Well, nobody's clear what to do, but I think why not to have a chance on that? I'm sorry. Oh, so maybe, Nilifor, and then you were before, Nilifor?
It doesn't matter, I'll defer. Thank you very much for that interesting presentation. I really enjoyed that, considering it's not a part of the world that I'm familiar with at all. So it was really interesting for me to listen and to learn. I have some experience over the last 10 years with Cuba, and I found myself, while you were talking, making comparisons in my mind about the kind of transitions and the kind of changes that I've seen and have experienced when I visit Cuba. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about that I see in Cuba is a Cuban colleague of mine says that the state is mentiroso sistematizado, which is like a systematic liar. Basically, what she's saying is that the state is a systematic liar, that that they don't. Give a statistical representation of what has happened to Cuban people since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the consequent impact of that collapse on the Cuban economy, they pretend, or there's a certain amount of pretense in how that impact has affected the Cuban people statistically and how that is represented. So I wanted to find out from you how this has been handled in the transition, because it is something that I'm seeing, I'm picking up, that it must be part, I don't know if it's part of the socialist or communist experience to present an image of reality that isn't really there. But that is my own interpretation of it. I could be wrong, but that is what I've picked up before, right? And when you said that thing about the beautiful buildings and the shell behind, I mean, there's so many places in Cuba that's exactly what you see. So I pretty much wanted to ask how is that done, and also when you're looking at the collection of data now, how are you? You said the state was not prepared to handle that. What have you done in since then to compensate? Because how are you? Are the indices of poverty, is it based on estimates, or are you actually you're actually setting up apparatuses within the state to collect data to be able to measure poverty and to measure the movement of you know, people's social and economic conditions in the society?
There are two questions, but I think they are very interesting questions. No, this Potemkin villages, this was in a late 18th century, and this was not now. But you can compare it a little bit what happens now in the PR business in these countries. It's a tremendous business, and sometimes I have doubts if this democracy really brought a very open, frank and transparent picture of reality, because most politicians are employing massively PR people, which are the whole teams, and they would say things which, for example, I know are not true, but most people who are watching that, they don't know. How could they don't? One person says this and the other. So this is this is what is typical for most of these countries. In order to get a political power, they go very much to the U.S. system, and they have advisors from the U.S. If there are any elections or anything, they have a PR people. How you behave, what you sell, what you tell. So it's not much to do. Well, I'm a bit my sharing my views. I really feel it's a pity, because we were expecting that under this democracy you will have very much like transparent. Of course you can write everything now, you can publish. There are many critical arguments, there are different views and this. But it's a lot of brainwashing as well. And I think in Cuba they have to do it, because this is how the population have to, you know, otherwise you would not maintain the country. So that's what it is. Now, how you measure poverty, how you measure this? You know, poverty research in transition countries under socialism were very few institutes which were actually producing data, and this was secret data. They were not shared with the public. And they were done based on national poverty lines, which were calculated very differently. Some of them were at the food level, like the minimum food intake, calories. Some of them were at the median income, etc. And they were only shared with the top policy officials in a country. So it opened up in 89-90, but you still don't have many data. It's a very difficult. Our statistical office publishes officially national poverty line. Now, this is not comparable across countries, because the only there are different poverty lines, you cannot just compare them. So the and there's the parity problems, the purchase power parities. So the only ones which are relied are used for international comparisons are those of the World Bank, and this is the Macrovalion and monopoly of the data, and Branko Milanović, who has a very good set of data, which he has a database for all transition countries, and he revised them every few years, because these are not easy data to get. He makes estimates. So they are not so, judging from this data, believe me, it's very confusing picture, very confusing. You need to go there to talk to people, and much more reliable on national data, when you can you know, talk to people and see. And believe me, it's a lot of poverty.
Yeah. Now, Rania, sorry, nearly for Rania and Guru. Yeah. And
this is so, you know, so interesting, Eva. Thank you so very much. And we could probably have 5 more sessions on this, because there are so many things to learn, discuss, debate. I have a couple of questions. I'll try to be brief. What is the status of Kalecki in Poland? Because every time I utter the word Keynesian or hear the word Keynes, post-Keynesian, I'm always wanting to switch to Kaleckian. And I am so Kalecki and myself. So this is one thing I want to learn. After all the shock and the non-therapy you have, did people go back to somebody they actually was one of their own? The second thing is, in a lot of countries, you know, we talk about we want to have quotas, 50-50, which is, you know, obviously, I mean, Polish case is great. We also look at wages, but there are a number of countries where women's educational attainment is higher than men's. So really, women should be getting higher wages than men. And we're still sort of aspiring to get to the same level, whereas we should be getting higher wages. That's the thing that is scandalous. And I don't know what kind of comment you can make on that. I mean, seeing that the wages are equal itself wouldn't even be a sign of, you know, equality. But we are also used to thinking of, you know, if we just get to 45% of what they get, we're still doing very much better and so on. And the third thing is that, of course, we know in a lot of ways from a number of cross-country experiences, when wage-setting institutions are more centralized than decentralized, these gaps are always lower. And of course, we can point to the experience of the socialist countries in terms of the gaps, you know, wage payments of men and women. But also very important thing is that, of course, part of the wages of people in a society come from what we call the social wage. And there was a complete collapse of this wage exactly in the, incredible portion of the wages, mm-hmm. incomes that were lost, which came from this mm-hmm. Loss in the social wage. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that? You know, what happens in the loss of the, the process of crisis, but in this case it wasn't a crisis, it was a really transition, or actually this was a situation or a process of what we would call really primitive accumulation. I mean, that's what happened in Russia, right? All of a sudden you created two classes of people who used to be both collective owner of the means of production. You created the oligarchs, and you created the people who are who have nothing but their labor power. This was one of the most condensed processes of primitive accumulation in all of history, and one of the most, probably the most horrendous redistribution in history, in all recent economic history. What happened in Russia, and also to some degree in other countries as well. So the question is then: is there a search for a kind of a different paradigm now that these, you know, so-called so we still use the word transition, but I don't know what else to say, so I'm going to say transition. Now that there was a transition from socialism, actually from one sort of mode of production to another, to capitalism, to capitalism of the most brutal kind, because there are also varieties of capitalism. Some forms of capitalism are more brutal than other kinds of capitalism, which are more sort of have a human face and perhaps even a human heart, or a more humane heart, I would say. Is there really a search in this sort of paradigmic sense, in this larger sense of trying to shift the way of thinking? And that sort of relates to my first question on Kaletsky, actually, in Eastern Europe, in other than sort of let's try to deal with the crisis, because this is not crisis, this is a sort of a moment of a rupture for the world as a whole, and maybe this is not being felt as a rupture in some places yet, but it's a rupture.
Maybe I can respond quickly, or we. Okay. Yes, that will be fine. Okay.
Very short question. I see you a lot talk about the transition to democracy. Uh-huh. I heard you call actually the existing situation or existing phase now, if I may call, democracy. And I wanted to get your definition of democracy. And I ought to understand why do you call it democracy when you have described a very brutal situation in terms of increase in poverty, increase of inequality. What do you mean by democracy in that sense?
Well, I'm not sure if I am very clear on rephrasing my question, but during your presentation, what came out to me was like men, you know, during the transition to market economies, it seemed like men and women claimed very different spheres and then ended up in very different positions. So, you know, on the assumption that macro conditions make the man and woman, what kind of processes were really instrumental in, why did women end up in such different places? And if there were, for example, no support for elderly and care work, why did women immediately claim those positions? Like, I'm just curious.
I'll try to be okay. I'll try to be very brief. When we look at wage disparities, we are always interested in labor market segmentation, industrial sort of paths of development, what was happening sectorally, and to see the extent to which some of the both labor force participation and wage differentials can be understood within that framework. Now, I'm sure there is some work that has been done, and my question is not necessarily on the spot, but would you be kind enough to share with us any literature that exists in this area, because we have tried to do some work. Actually, Tamar has been looking in this area and has done some work. And in English, at least, there isn't enough. But as she is multilingual and from Georgia, perhaps she would benefit from other literature that exists that is not translated. The second point I wanted to make was that I'm putting this too early on the table, actually, for discussion. But when we look at wage differentials, I will argue very, very strongly that it is not labor market desegregation, but comparable worth policies that have worked, in the sense that the countries that have the lowest wage differential today, Sweden, Australia, Finland, they had active labor market policy of comparable worth, where we can discuss what that is, but it is action by the government, government intervention that said it is illegal, essentially, given the skills that you have, et cetera, to have these gaps. And those are the countries that have closed the gap the most. Emil Memis, who is not here, has been working with me on this question for the last 4 or 5 months, and we hope that we will come out with a paper that will put all kinds of questions about this a little bit in perspective. So if there is space, I wanted to ask you at the moment, because this sounds very much like control of prices, right? Given that these are all transition countries, is there space for you or for other people to introduce this? And my last comment and question to you is has to do with the macro framework and IMF policies at the moment, especially at the time of crisis, because I can never envision the promotion of gender equality outside the conservative nature or progressive nature of macro frameworks. So I will only give the example of Ukraine. It was signed, the agreement, as you know, was signed just a few months back. And what they were told was that in order for them to be able, yeah, I see a lot of, okay, so most of you have heard this story. So in order to get the loan, which we know is not, when you look at the external balances of Ukraine, and when you look at the improvements that they had in terms of accumulation of the reserves, and all of a sudden, in a matter of 3 months, they get such rapid deterioration and they go to borrow money, we know it is because of the crisis. And they are told they have to balance their budget within the year. Ethiopia, just to mention a little bit that case also, was told that in addition to that, any public sector cannot borrow from the internal or external markets, public enterprises and social services and for whatever else. They can simply not borrow if they want to accept it. So if this is the framework that we are facing at the moment, is there any movement essentially from within, I don't know, Poland and the reaction in Ukraine, and are there any voices that are coming from the ground essentially that are contesting it? And if not, just your views on what is next. Thank you.
You have a minute, Eva.
This whole economic shortage, you know, Janos Korna and all of those, of course, we know that people were lined up, couldn't get. The way to cut the lines down, of course, was simply to, so people not, to, you had now the commodities, high prices, but people didn't have the income, so you got rid of the lines. But in either case, it meant that people were not able to be provisioned. with what they wanted and what they needed. So, you know, in the economics of shortage, you have the problem of people not accessing things. but also in the sort of the capitalist transition, if I will say, you have still the same problem. So if you look at the problem from the point of view of provisioning of needs, we have the same problem, but appearing in different ways. So this is why I'm asking, you know, is there a search for a new paradigm, new way of...
Interesting questions, and I think it's a time, you know, for the other session, because I think this is really what it... I can tell you what I think about that. You know, I don't have really ready answers. And this will link with you. So redistribution and look for Kaletskine. Kaletsky was my professor at Warsaw School of Economics. I have very good grades from him. I was very... No, I'm not kidding. I was he retired, but he was still teaching, and it was just before he left. This was his last year. I was very privileged to attend his classes, and I have in my book of student, I have his signature. So when I taught Richard Jolly at the then and Magda decided, oh, you knew Kaletsky, so I felt a little bit like from the history. But you see, you have to see, and that's my interpretation, that's why I was telling about this hangover of socialism and this very strong will of people that they want to live better and have shops full. Of course, now they have no money to buy it, and they have access-based limits to get things, but they can see it. There are shop windows, they are everything. It's an incentive for them to take an extra job, to do this, to do that. So I can tell you that, but the whole redistribution process have no precedent in history. And it happened in such a short time, and it just happened. I'm wondering myself why we didn't have any civil wars or things like this, because some people really were completely, you know, in Russia, people do this speculation in Russian crisis, people lost everything, the small people, the big people managed to get it. Okay, but this is still, in my view, maybe 2 points. The redistribution process, we have to understand it, were taking place without any institutions in place. And you were not doing it in the regular market system when everything works. There was no bank, no financial system, no parliaments working properly, no democracy. I mean, democracy. What did it mean? You cannot do democracy overnight. And in fact, that's my personal view again, the democracy which we have now, it's in fact something we already observe in the French Revolution. You know, the winners, the solidarity leaders, are fighting each other who's the most important and who should get a credit for bringing people, Poland, to liberty. And this are in many other countries. They are trying to, you know, play the game. This is politics. So it's of course it's democracy, because you can say it, you can openly did it, but it's a fight. And redistribution was really done without any institutions in place. And I think those who were redistributing were setting institutions once they already redistributed. And this is very similar to some of the primitive redistribution, even in the United States, you know, last century, this is how it was a little bit going. Well, not very much the same, but at least this was done in some countries slowed it down, this redistribution process, you know, like Uzbekistan, Central Asia, in the Ukraine. You know, Lukashenko, the president of Ukraine, still keeps a very strong hand on the economy and on everything. He doesn't let it go for the liberalization. And apparently, I have to look into this, why it all happened, because it will have effect. But now I believe, Nilifor, that this is really time, because there are a couple of economies who are trying to make maybe not a Kaletsky's comeback, because Kaletsky was not so much, his thinking was not very popular. Most of economies went to the business schools. Most of them were market economy, financial sector, efficiency, of whatever. But now they are coming back a bit, trying in the context of the crisis again, looking for better macroeconomic policy. And I think there are some economies which are claiming we need something new. But they do not, I'll be finishing. They do not propose anything yet. And there are some groups which are claiming that we need more redistribution, that we need to replace social wage. A comment very short on social wage. Yes, women lost most of it because wages were the same level, and then large of this, kindergartens and everything was in kind or in services. And this was a social wage for women mostly. And they were, you know, all of this, nobody, I haven't seen how, you know, I have to look into some, maybe there were some estimates how much of this wage was lost. But women lost most of this social wage. And now there are some attempts, even Grzegorz was telling that he's thinking about some of the employer of the last resort around the unemployment, which is now skyrocketing in Poland. Politicians are really thinking they want to do something, and they look for options, how and what. There is a program, for example, for women over 45 to be employed because they cannot find a job otherwise. So there are lots of different things trying, but it's very, very little. So unfortunately, I think it's still to come. I will not answer to all questions. I just wanted maybe, you know, democracy. I think democracy is a big issue, and certainly it's very different in different countries. You know, some countries feel they are democratic, and it's such a broad thing. And I think all these countries, transition countries, are just learning democracy. And I think it's still not done. It's still the process which is going on. We are learning, we are looking, and I think it will come one day. For the wage literature, I will certainly send something if I find most of this in Polish, Rania. So, but okay, I will see what I can have. Now, the last thing I want to comment is this wage differentials in active labor market policy in Scandinavian countries. If you look why and how they achieved it, most of the things they achieved, they went through the public sector. And that's why the gap diminished. There was a driving force. While if you look at the situation in transition countries, there were cuts in public sector. So this was completely the other way. But women were moved, the jobs were moved there because they could get the jobs. But at the expense of the level of income, of wages. And so far, there's no really real moves, for example, to increase the wages of nurses. They were on a huge strike, I think 2 years ago, and they were camping outside the prime minister's office and everything. It was they didn't get. But if coal miners go, they are getting something. They are not getting, you know, pension privileges and others. So it's a power structure which is there. And that's why this thing for quotas. And you have to remember, the quotas is just a proposal from the Congress, which is nothing like, it's nothing. I mean, it has to go through all the system. And there's lots of opposition to quotas, even among women. So thank you so much for very, very interesting and inspiring questions. And we need some break for the...